Okay, so last class we were talking about memory management. Today we are going to switch gears, start talking about file systems. But just to recap, we talked about page replacement algorithms. Specifically, we saw that adding memory to a process doesn't necessarily increase its performance in terms of paging. Page faults can increase, okay, as the even if the memory allocated to a machine goes up. Okay, this phenomenon is called Belady's anomaly. Alright, so we'll talk about Belady's anomaly. We looked at several LRU variants. There's one called clock, there's one second chance, and there's another one called enhanced second chance. Okay. Both of those are necessary because efficient implementation of cache replacement algorithms is challenging. It requires you to keep track of additional statistics like timestamps, which slows down performance significantly. So you need to come up with approximations that either leverage hardware support or have very low overheads. Okay, so that was the motivation for second chance and enhanced second chance. And towards the end of last class, we talked about how to allocate memory to a process, how do we determine its working set size and so on. Okay, so that's where we are going to continue. Okay, just as a reminder, we have a closed laptop, no cell phone policy in class. Okay, I think it's a sort of people have started using phones and whatnot and laptops, so don't use them in class, it distracts others. Alright? Okay, so let me continue from last time. Okay, so this is where we left off. We said, how do we determine the working set size? Basic idea is you have a window of time. Over that window, you observe the process behavior, see which pages it accessed, and the set of pages that you accessed over any time interval delta is the working set size. In this case, that's the reference stream. Those numbers there show you which pages have been accessed by that process over time. This is the time window represented by delta. And within this time window, the process has accessed these 5 pages, so that is its working set. Okay. And working set changes over time, so in this other window now there are only 2 pages. Okay. So there is also this question of how do you decide delta. You want delta to be large enough so that you don't fault frequently. Okay. So if you have all of the pages that are accessed over this whole time window in memory, it follows that you will not have a page fault in that window. Okay, until the working set itself changes. Okay, so you want to ensure that is always the case. Okay, but even doing this is expensive. Okay, if you have a window and you are actually tracking actual page references, for every memory access you have to keep track somewhere, some statistic which says which page you access. That's a memory access for every page reference or every memory access the process is making. That is expensive. Again, you have a factor of 2 slowdown. Okay. So working sets are expensive to compute. Okay. So if you cannot even compute working set, then how do you allocate pages to processes? How do you decide how many pages to allocate? So what you could do is, instead of computing the working set, you can use a proxy for whether you are given enough pages, and that proxy metric is the page fault frequency. Okay. If you gave a process too few pages, to a memory that is smaller than its working set, it follows that it is going to start page faulting. Okay? And conversely, if you give it too much, okay, it will have very little page fault behavior. Okay? So if you actually track the page fault frequency of a process, which is easy because page faults are rare, so incrementing a counter every time there's a page fault is not that big a deal. Incrementing a counter every time there's a memory access is a big deal from a performance standpoint. So if you just track page fault frequency, that's pretty easy. So if the page fault frequency is above some threshold, if it goes above some value, let's say 5%, okay, then you say that this process is starting to fault more often than you would like. You give it some more pages. Okay, and then if it goes below a certain threshold, let's say if it's below 0.1% or 0.01%, say this process has too much memory, is not faulting at all. Occasional faulting is okay. Maybe you can use that RAM for something else. Okay, so you can take away page frames if it's less than a certain value. Okay. This curve here is essentially showing that algorithm in a graphical form. This is a plot that has the number of frames allocated to the process on the x-axis page fault rate on the y-axis. And what the blue curve is showing you the behavior of the process in terms of faulting. Right? As you give more memory, okay, the number of the page fault decreases. That's all it is showing. Okay? So those two thresholds are these lines. Okay, if the page fault rate goes above this threshold, the upper bound, then you say it's faulting too frequently, you have to sort of drive it down there by giving it more memory. Conversely, if it's below a lower bound, you say maybe you gave it too much RAM. Okay? So you can use the page fault behavior to determine whether you have enough pages to accommodate the working set size, instead of explicitly tracking the working set and then giving it 5 or 7 pages depending on the size. Okay, so that's basically how most operating systems actually work. They don't necessarily do this. This is a more accurate thing to do. Rather, they do this to approximate working set computation. Okay. The last thing is actually a hardware issue. This is what should be the size of a page. Okay, so as I had mentioned early on when we talked about paging, typically page sizes are some power of 2. Okay, and most hardware, they range between 1 and 8 kilobytes. Okay, 1K to 8K. On Intel architecture, they are in the 4K range. Okay, but some other hardware, you might have 8K pages and so on. But now there are trade-offs between choosing a large page and a small page size. Okay, so if you pick a small page size, you are making more effective use of RAM, okay, because the internal fragmentation will go down. You can allocate memory more precisely. If you have half a K page, you can allocate to within half a K of what the process actually wants, quarter K. So higher degree of multi-programming is possible because you can keep fewer pages and swap out more. Okay, if you have small pages, you can afford to keep less and that may still be okay. Okay. On the other hand, if you have large pages, okay, so the advantages of having large pages, if you have a 16K, 32K, 64K pages, okay, you will have smaller page table. For a given size of RAM, okay, you will have fewer pages. Okay, that means page tables have to be smaller. Okay, every time you double the page size, the page table, the effective page table size is going to half. Okay, so large pages means smaller page sizes. Okay, you basically also amortize your page fault benefit over a larger page. Every time there's a page fault, you fetch more stuff from disk, so more of the process contents actually arrive in RAM. Okay, that basically will decrease the page fault rate. Okay, for smaller pages, you may have more page faults because there are all these little pieces you have to fetch. For each little piece, you will have a page fault. Okay, so this basically amortizes disk over it. It means there are fewer faults. Okay. So those are reasons for either choosing a small or a large page, and obviously you want to balance both of those trade-offs. Okay? Now, all that said, page sizes are still continuing to grow, and that is because the RAM sizes are also growing. Okay? So as you buy every new generation of your laptop, okay, you basically get 2 times or more RAM than you had in the previous generation. Okay? If you have more RAM, that means there is more pages to track. Page tables have to grow. Okay? But if you keep growing page tables, all these kernel data structures keep blowing up. The only way around it is to make the page bigger so that the data structure size doesn't grow as the amount of RAM on your machine grows. Okay? So over time, page sizes are tended to grow. If you take a 15-20 year time frame, if you look at page sizes then and now, probably older machines would have had 1K page size. Today you are sort of in the 4 to 8K range. Okay? And as RAM sizes increase, probably that is going to grow to 16K or more. Over time. Okay. So those are the reasons that page sizes are increasing. CPU speed is also increasing, but as you have more faster CPUs, that means you might fault more frequently because you can execute more instructions within a given time. Yes, question.
Why does the hardware determine the page size? Why is that not an operating system software?
Why does the hardware determine? Okay, so the OS, so I should rephrase this. There are some limits that are placed by the hardware. Okay, beyond those limits, the OS can actually decide a page size. Okay, and the limits are how you address memory. Okay, depending on how you address what your word size is, etc., there are limits placed on the page size. Remember that when I said how do you determine virtual to physical address mapping, you have to extract these bits, the page number and so on. That is actually built in the hardware. okay, the P and the D. So if you say I am only going to look at the top 20 bits, that's the size of your page, right? Or the offset determines the size of your page. So to that level you can do that, but beyond that there is some flexibility at the OS as well. Okay, so now let's come back to, there's one more slide on memory management and then we will be done. Okay, the only other point I wanted to make here before we move on is how kernel memory is dealt with. Okay, all of the process memory is paged and possibly segmented. Okay, so you use segmented paging for typical user processes, stuff, memory is fetched from disk on demand, etc. Okay, for kernel, that's not the case. Okay, think of the kernel as a special process where most of its memory is actually hardwired, it's pinned. It's called pinned pages. So that means you cannot swap it out. If you pin a page to memory, okay, that means that this page cannot be swapped out. It has to be resident in RAM at all times. Much of kernel memory, okay, much of what the kernel uses is actually resident in RAM at all times. Okay, that's number one. Okay, so that basically says most operating system kernels themselves, okay, if you think of kernel as address space, that address space is not paged. Okay, user address spaces are paged, brought in from disk on demand. Okay, but kernel address spaces are not. Kernel entire address space is resident. That's the first thing. The second thing is even the operating system kernel has a need to do dynamic memory allocation as data structures shrink and grow. Yeah, you may want to allocate a new process control block, for instance. Okay, that's allocating some memory. Okay, you can't call malloc from inside the kernel. You can't say new inside the kernel. Okay, the kernel has to do its own memory management. Okay, user programs have access to library that allow you to instantiate a new object, allocate some new piece of memory. The kernel doesn't have access to this library. So typically most OS kernels will have to have their own inbuilt allocator. Okay, the kernel will have to do its own internal memory dynamic memory management. Okay, so there are two allocators that are used typically. One is called a buddy allocator, the other one is called a slab allocator. Early versions of Linux had actually used the buddy allocator. Now they actually do the slab allocation. Buddy allocator basically says that you will allocate memory, okay, internally within the kernel. You will allocate memory to data structures in the powers of two. Okay, so you can't ask for odd size or anything. That's not a power. You can ask for a piece of memory that's 2 bytes, 4 bytes, 16 bytes, 32 bytes, and so on. Okay, so you will see that many kernel data structures, okay, they actually round them off. They stuff some bits so that each entry in that data structure is some power of 2 for this very reason. Okay, because if you allocate memory in powers of 2, just to simplify, if you could arbitrarily allocate some memory, then kernel memory management, inside the kernel memory management becomes more complex. So you simplify certain things. Okay, so you allocate memory in powers of 2. This can of course lead to internal fragmentation. If you only needed 3 bytes, you can only allocate 4. Okay, so you wasted 1 byte. Or if you needed 13 bytes, you have to allocate the next power of 2, which is 16. Okay. So buddy allocator allocates memory in sizes of 2. The slab allocator is essentially a little more flexible. It basically groups objects of the same size into a slab. Okay, and there is a cache that is maintained that points to slabs and so on. There is a So in the slab allocator is slabs of different slices. So you have slab 1, slab 2 and so on. Each slab contains objects of some sizes. So this might contain objects that are between 8 and 16 bytes in size. Okay, so you can have objects of different size here. This might have, let's say, all 4K objects, or not 4K, let's say 16 byte objects, 32 byte objects, and so on. So what happens is every time you need to allocate an object of a certain size, you go and look at the corresponding slab. A slab could be a page or some number of pages, okay, that are pre-allocated for you. And you say, is there an empty slot in that page? If there's an empty slot, that is the slot that you will allocate to that new object. Okay? If there is no empty slot, then you will allocate a new slab for this size objects and then start chopping up these into smaller chunks and allocating them. Okay, it's almost like paging, but these are sort of, you're handing out chunks of different sizes. Okay, this slab allocates chunks of 16 bytes. Okay, this slab allocates chunks of 32 bytes. Some other slab may allocate chunks of byte 64 and so on. So whenever you need an object to basically go and look, saying, and so each slab may have some number of slots. Is there a free slot? If so, you allocate it. If not, the whole slab is used up, you allocate a new chunk of memory. And you chop it up into that sized slots and you allocate a slot from there. So that's basically how you will do memory management. You will not allocate smaller chunks, you will allocate these big slabs at a time and you will chop it up into chunks of fixed size and hand them out one at a time. Yes, question.
Are you wasting like a lot of memory? If there's only like 132 bit per byte.
Yes. Process. Yes. You are right that you may waste memory, because if you in the entire kernel you only had 132 byte object, you have to at least allocate a slab first and then chop up a slot from there. And so slab can be at least one page. So you will allocate a 4K chunk and then chop it up into some number of 32 byte and then you will only allocate this. And then the rest will go to waste. But you do that for efficiency reason. Otherwise you have to maintain a linked list of objects inside the kernel. It gets very messy. Okay, so to simplify things, you will either do that or you are going to do something like this. Okay, so you will have slabs of different sizes. You go to a slab, look for a slot, and then you will allocate. So objects can be allocated and deallocated on the fly. Okay, if you this object gets deallocated, this slot frees up. Next time you need a 32 byte chunk, you go and allocate this slot. Okay, this is how you are going to do it. Okay, so we don't go into the details of buddy and slab allocator here. All I want you to remember are two things. One is kernel address spaces are not paged. Kernel memory is typically pinned to RAM. Okay, the entire kernel typically tends to be inside in RAM. That's the first thing. The second thing is the way kernel does, unlike user processes, kernels don't have access to libraries that do sophisticated memory management for them. Okay. Java does its own garbage collection, etc., etc. Kernels don't have that kind of luxury. They have to implement their own memory allocators, and typically the ones they do are very simple ones. Okay, because you just don't have to worry about internal memory allocation in addition to all this other ones. Okay, so you have your own thing inside the kernel. And these are the two common ones that are used in many kernels. Okay, so that's all we really need to keep in mind here. Okay, so that basically concludes the discussion on memory management. Okay, so we are done with the second big component of the course. First one was process management. Okay, so this is done. Okay, so this we just finished. So now we are going to start talking about how the operating system manages the disk, okay, and all I/O devices. Okay, so you are happy.
I'm excited for this.
Okay, so there are two things here. One, we will use disk as an example of an I/O device and look in more detail how the disk is managed. But then we will relax that and say, how do we use these ideas to manage any I/O device? Okay, so it's storage and I/O. We are going to mix both of this in this component. But the main I/O device we are going to look at is the disk inside a machine. Okay, so we have looked at the CPU already. That's all processes and threads. We have done memory, address spaces, and now we look at disk. Okay, so we are going to start with some basics. So today we look at the interface that the OS provides to programs to manage disk space. Okay, and that interface is essentially file management and managing directories. Okay, next time, okay, so that's basically this interface. It's a system call interface that you export it to applications. Applications use that interface to create files, delete files, create directories, manipulate directories, and so on. Okay, so we are only going to talk about this layer today. Next time we are going to peek inside the hood and say, what is inside a file system? How does the file system manage files? How does it allocate space to files? How does it track which blocks of the disk are free, which ones are in use? We'll see some analogy to how the operating system manages memory. Okay? Similar stuff has to happen on disk. Okay, you have to keep track of files instead of address spaces, but similar concept. But that is coming next. Okay, so today we only look at the API. Okay, so that's the interface. Now, as this picture shows, this is also what is called device independent and device dependent. Okay, this interface that we are going to talk about is independent of what your storage device is. Whether you have a magnetic hard disk, whether you have a solid state disk, maybe it's a CD ROM or a DVD ROM, maybe it's a USB thumb drive, it doesn't matter. Okay? Regardless of the underlying hardware, you use the same API to open files, to create files, to manage files on that device. So it's a device independent API. So it doesn't matter if the underlying device might change, but your program can continue to work with the same API. Okay, so you don't need to have a separate interface for every single API. Internally, something has to change as the device changes. Okay, so if it's a CD ROM or a DVD ROM device, it's a write once read menu. Once you have written to it, once you burn that media, you can't write to it. You can read data from it. Okay? So how you manage that device from the OS perspective will change depending on the device itself. Okay? But from a programming standpoint, that shouldn't change. That should be a device independent abstraction. Okay, so today we'll start with this layer and then we are going to come and talk about this layer. Okay? So first we'll start with some very basic stuff. Okay? So what are we trying to sort of do with the data that is stored on disk? What properties do we want with it? Okay, the first and main property that we are looking for is what is called persistence. Okay, persistence basically says anything you put on this device is going to stay there across reboot cycles. Okay, memory is what is called a volatile medium. Okay, any data in RAM goes away if your machine reboots. Okay, disk is a non-volatile medium. Any data you put on disk does not go away if you reboot your machine. The data stays there. Okay, unless you corrupt the device, that's a file system, that's a different problem. But so long as the disk is, the file system integrity is maintained, the persistence is given to you. Okay, so that's the first and the most important property we want from our file system. Some other properties are speed. If you are trying to access a file, you need to be able to get to that data quickly. Okay? We will look at organizations or files where sometimes it takes a long time to get to a certain item that you are looking for in a file, and in other cases you can get to it in very quickly. Okay? So the organization of how you have placed your data on disk matters, and so we'll see how different organizations give you different efficiencies. Okay? Size is another important thing. Okay? Disks are growing bigger and bigger. Okay? Now you can buy for barely $100 1 terabyte disk. Okay? That's a lot of disk space. You could create literally millions of little files on it, or maybe small number of very large files. Okay? You need to be able to accommodate this diversity. Okay? Small file, large files, all of that you need to be able to access efficiently whenever possible. Okay, one more property we want from data is basically sharing and protection. Okay, if certain files are private, but your machine is accessible to multiple users, you need to be able to protect that data. You should need to be able to prevent other users from getting to that data. Okay? At the same time, if you are interested in sharing certain files, you should be able to do that as well. Okay? If you are working with your lab partner on a project, you want files that you are creating for your lab assignment to be accessible to both and no one else. Okay? Only the two people are working on. Okay? So you need to be able to do all of this. Okay? And last but not least, you need ease of use. Okay, you don't want users to think of or remember mundane details about data that they have stored. Okay, you need to be able to let users access their data quickly. We will see how file systems have also evolved along this dimension. Okay, so here is basically the hardware features and the OS features that give us the first three properties: persistence, speed, and size. Okay, persistence the hardware gives us. Okay, disks are already non-volatile. Okay, anything you put on disk, we assume stays there across reboot cycle. Okay, speed you get from random access. Okay, essentially your hard disk, okay, is a random access device, as compared to let's say a tape drive, which is a linear access device. If you write to a tape drive, and if you return to the end of the tape drive, I don't know if anyone of you have even seen a tape drive, but I hope you know what a tape drive is. It's something that you use to back up data. Okay, but it's essentially not a random access device. You basically record. It's almost like recording on a VCR. So think of it as DVD versus a video cassette. Okay? If you want to jump to a certain scene in a movie and you essentially have a video cassette, then you have to basically fast forward and wait until you reach that point in the movie. On a DVD, you basically can just pick the chapter and jump to it instantaneously. Okay? Same is true of hard disk versus a tape drive. So hard disks basically give you speed because they are random access, unlike some other storage devices. Okay, size I already mentioned, disks keep getting bigger. Okay, typical disk sizes are now in hundreds of gigabytes. Okay, this is no longer typical. I think terabyte is not typical. Okay. What does the OS do using that hardware device? So basically persistence, it allows you to recover from, not recover, but every time you reboot, it ensures that your data is there. When the file system has issues with respect to consistency, it allows you to recover data. Okay, in some file system, you can undelete deleted files. Okay. So a lot of additional stuff is available to you. Okay. Sharing and protection is used. You can use access control lists. You can use privileges, read, write, and execute privileges to decide who has access to what kind of files. And I'll show you some examples. Okay. Ease of use. The simplest thing you do is the ability to name files. Okay. You don't think of this as ease of use, but essentially from an OS perspective, all files are just numbers. Every file has a unique number inside the file, inside the OS. Okay. So now imagine how difficult your life would be if files only had numbers but not names. Okay. You create a file and then you have to remember some number, 33,222. Okay. 10 days later, there's no way you're going to remember all of this detail. Okay. What the OS allows you to do is assign human readable, not human readable, but easy to remember names that you associate with a file. Right. lab1.java is something you can remember. A random number you cannot. Okay. Internally there is a mapping. Okay. So actually internal representation of a file has not changed. OS still deals with files and numbers. It doesn't really care. But there is a mapping that you have to do to go from a file name to the unique ID of a file, which is essentially an integer inside the OS. Okay. This is, I think, the biggest thing that allows you to get to your data. The other thing is the ability to organize files into directories. You can group things into directories. You don't have a flat namespace where all of your files are in one giant directory. You can organize files saying lab 1 directory has all the files for lab 1. Lab 2 might have all the things for lab 2. Your mail directory contains your email and so on and so forth. Okay, the ability to organize your data is another one. Okay, to this you should add now search. Okay, so modern operating system, until 5 years ago this was not even a feature. But today you can actually just search in Windows or Mac or many other operating systems, and it actually shows you all the files that might have searched. So you don't even need to remember the name of the file. Okay, you can just search for something that you can associate with the file and you can track it down. Okay, so that's yet another service that the OS provides you. Okay, so there is basically... The other thing that it simplifies, the OS simplifies your life, is it basically hides the details of how data is laid out on disk. Okay? Basically, the disk just looks to you as if it's a big storage device. You don't deal with this is where you put this file and this is some other place where you put some other file. The OS is managing all that. That's all transparent. Okay? You don't need to know and you don't need to really care about it. Okay, but internally a lot of work has to happen to make all of this possible. Okay, so search I already put here. Okay, so let's start with basic definition. So what, as I said, what I'm going to do is define the notion of a file, and then we'll look at this API, device independent API, which is a system call interface to manipulate files at the OS level. Okay, so what is essentially a file? So the definition is there. It's basically a named data container. Okay, a file is a container of some data. It contains some data that you have created and it has a name associated with it. Okay, so it's a name collection of related information recorded on a secondary storage device. Essentially it's a container of data. Okay, files have names. Every file has a name. Okay, reader.cc is a file, is a C++ program. A.out on Linux is a binary program, okay, binary executable. Okay. Files can contain arbitrary data. Okay, it can contain source code, it can contain binary data, it could contain Word documents, it could contain any arbitrary data. Okay. An important issue, which I think today is not as relevant, is whether files internally have a structure or not. Okay. Now, this is only relevant from a historical perspective. Okay, back in the old mainframe days, okay, files actually had a formal structure. Okay. Today, a file does not actually have a structure. Once you create a file, what you can put whatever you want inside that file. you can put arbitrary text, you can put binary. There is no a priori structure dictated on file. Okay, but in mainframes, okay, and this is still true, files actually have a structure. A file can be a sequence of records. Okay, so if you create a file of a certain kind, it will actually have a structure associated with it, saying you have records here, records are fields, and you can actually put different things in this field. So this could be an integer field, this could be a float field, this could be a string, and so on. Okay, you can only store records of this structure inside this file. Okay, each file can have a different structure. But when you create the file, you have to specify the structure you want for this file, and that limits how you can store data on this file. And this is built into the OS. Now, this was done before relational databases were actually invented. Okay, the file structure actually captured how database actually stores data in a file. Okay, and this was known to the file system, and it could do optimizations of how it stored this file on a disk and so on. Okay. Most modern operating systems don't do this. In most modern operating system, files are unstructured data containers. Okay, it's essentially a sequence of bytes as far as the OS is concerned. Okay, the OS just says this file has these many bytes. It does not interpret the bytes, does not impose a structure on the bytes. Okay, so you can store, user programs can store whatever they want inside a file. Okay, important distinction, although these days the need for structured data is even less, but these kinds of file systems exist. Okay, and every file has a number of attributes. Okay, so there's a name of a file, is a type of a file, location, size, protection, creation time, and whatnot. Okay, so you can actually look at, so I'll show you some examples here. Okay, so let's look at lecture 18. Okay, so this is all the attributes of this file. Okay. So this file system actually has a type associated with every file. So when you see, the first thing is that what kind of a file is it? It is Microsoft PowerPoint file. Okay, not all file systems actually have typed files. They may not associate a type or a meaning to a file. Some file systems do. This one does. It knows that that's the type of the file. So when you try to open it, it will open up a program or start up a program that is associated with that file type. And if your file doesn't have types, then the OS will not know, if you're trying to open it, what program to start. Okay, you have to start the program yourself. Okay, there's a distinction. We'll come back to that. There's a size of the file, that says how big it is. There's a location of the file. It shows you the path name and the directory it's stored in. Okay, there's a creation time. There's a modification time. Okay, there's a time that was opened last. All of this is tracked by the OS. Okay, multiple time fields associated with it. So here you can associate a program to use for this file, so you can basically change it if you want. Then when next time you click on it, it will use a different program to open this file. Okay. There's a preview associated with it, and here are all the permission bits. Okay. This says who can do what operation on this file. Okay, so it says the owner, which is me, can basically read and write. No one else has any access. You can change that. You can create an arbitrary access control list. You can say a very fine grain, saying for every user in your, so here you can pick this user or this group, and then you can say that this user can do this kind of stuff. Right, so then that's basically tracked as a list. For every file there is a list like this. It says what can the users do and so on. Okay. Now on top of this, because you can search, there are some additional things you can associate with files. So here this the search on Mac OS X is called Spotlight. It has, I think, Windows desktop search. Google has its own search thing that you can put on your desktop and so on. And that has actually tracks a whole bunch of other metadata. Yes, question.
The permissions and stuff, is that stored, like, that's part of the file, it's not stored in the index somewhere?
No. So it is stored somewhere else. This, whatever I showed you here, is not part of the file. This is called the metadata for the file. What is in this PowerPoint document is the data for the file. All of this stuff is called metadata. Metadata is typically stored separately from the data.
So like all that is like the header to like the actual data?
Yeah. So it's not a header, it's stored somewhere else, in an index structure, as we will talk about. Okay, so there's a separate index structure that tracks stuff for every file. All of this information is in there. Okay. So this is not, none of this stuff is in the file itself. Okay? Whatever in the file is this, whatever we are seeing in the file, that is tracked separately by the OS and associated with this file. Okay, it's called a metadata for the file. Okay, metadata means data about the data. Okay, so that's basically information about the files. So here are some more things I can show. What is this? Okay, so this is basically my home directory on this machine. So those are actually names of files, but internally, this is actually the actual internal representation. That's the number associated with that file. Okay, every file has a unique number. That's the integer number for this file. Okay, so as far as the OS is concerned, that's what it uses to index and access files. As far as users are concerned, users don't even see this unless you look for it. You access files using the name. Okay? There's a mapping essentially between file names and file numbers. Okay, the number is the unique ID of that file. That mapping is also maintained by the OS. That's also metadata for that file. Okay? So as we go and start looking at internals of file system, we'll look at where this number is stored, how is it generated, how do you access a file. Once you give its name, how do you map it to its unique ID and so on. Okay? But all of these things exist internally. Okay? So that's something that you should keep in mind. Okay, so back to files. Okay, so today we'll talk about the interface to access files. Okay, so there are set of system calls. Okay, that you use to manipulate files, okay, as well as directories. These are typical operations that you do on a file. Okay, so this is a system call interface to manage files. So you use create to create a new file, to delete a file, open to open a file, close, seek, whatever, those kind of things. And these are all operations that you can use to change, get the metadata, change the metadata and so on. Okay, so get attribute. Will get all the attributes I was just showing you for the file. Okay, set attribute will allow you to modify it. Okay, you can create hard links and soft links and show you what that is. You can rename files and so on. Okay, now the thing to keep in mind is whenever you write user programs, you are not programming at this level. Okay, this is a system called API to manipulate files. If you are writing a Java program, you are using the Java library. Okay, you can use the IO stream interface to access files. Internally, the IO stream calls that you are making are translated by the JVM to these calls. Okay, and what is actually hitting the OS is basically the JVM then makes these calls on your behalf. You could, of course, program at this level, but then you are doing system call programming at the system call level. It's a fairly low level of programming. It gives you a lot of raw power, but in many cases, you probably don't need it. You are better off using a higher level interface to deal with files. Okay, so these are two important data structures. So what I will do today is talk about how the system calls are implemented internally. Okay, to understand that, you need to keep in mind what are the data structures that the OS maintains for every file. So there are two key data structures. One is a global file table, and the other one is called a per process file table. As the name global file table suggests, it is essentially a list of all the files that are currently open by any process in the system. Okay? And the per process file table says for every given for a given process, what are the files that it is currently accessing. Okay, so the global table is a global list and the per process one is a per process list. Okay? Internally, the OS has to keep track of this. For every process, it has to figure out what is currently open, and we'll see why. Okay? Why that is the case. And what is stored in each of this is also mentioned in here. So in the global file table, for every file, you have to say how many processes have opened this file. More than one process can open the same file at the same time. Okay? That is allowed. Okay? There are all these file attributes that are basically also kept track of. Location, some initial locations are kept track of. There's pointers to locations in memory. We have done an M map of that file. You have to keep track of where it is resident in memory. Okay. The main thing in the per process file table is the per process state of the file. The biggest thing that the OS has to keep track of is the current pointer in the file. Okay, so this is a, let's say this is a file q.java. If you open this program from inside an application, okay, at any given time, depending on how much of this you have read, your file, there is a file pointer that points to the next byte of that file. The next time you read, it will actually read from that location on. Okay, this I presume that you probably are aware of how this works, but internally the OS has to keep track of it, and that information is stored here. So whenever you say read the next 10 bytes, where to read from is actually tracked here, okay, and then you basically issue a read call to the disk starting at that offset. So that is something that the OS has to keep track of for every process in the system. That state that you have to keep track of for that process. Okay? So with those two data structures, let's look at some key system calls. See how, what OS has to do internally. Okay, the first and the most simplest one is called create. Okay? Although it's called create, the way you actually spell it in Unix is without the E. Okay, so don't ask why, that's the name of the system call. Okay, so if you call create, you can see what basically the API looks like. Let me just do man create. Okay, so essentially, if you want to create a file, you specify a path name and you specify a mode you want to open that file. Okay, that will create a new file with that name. Okay, so you say user shenoy foo. If you specify that string here, then it will create a new file called foo in my home directory. And you can specify a mode. So here is basically the mode basically says write, read, write only, or if you want to truncate the file, and there are various options, okay, which we will not go into. Okay, so that's your create system call. So when you issue create, okay, here are all the things that need to happen internally. The first thing you need to check, do you have enough disk space to create a new file? Okay, if you are out of disk space, you will return an error, meaning out of space. Okay. Next thing you will check is disk quotas and whatnot. So let's assume all those succeed. And then you will create what is called a file descriptor. Okay. A file descriptor is essentially an internal descriptor that the OS uses to keep track of what file you are referring to. Okay. You use the name only the first time. When you do open or create, it returns a file descriptor which is essentially an integer. Okay. From that point on, you use that file descriptor to refer to that file. You do no longer use the name to access that file every time. Okay. So whenever you create a file as well, you will create a file descriptor and return that as part of the create system call. Okay. And so then basically what you have to do are several things. You have to add that name to the directory for the file, saying I just created a new file. Okay, the file has to show up in the directory listing. Okay, so the OS has to go and insert that. If the file has a type, then you have to associate a type with that file also. That information has to be inserted into the metadata. So if it's a Word file, you just add the type as the Word file and so on. Okay, so small number of operations, but all of those. Some error checks have to be done. Then you create the file, insert it into the directory, and then you are done. Okay, then you have created a new file. At this point, it's an empty file. Okay, it's a new file that has no data in it. Okay, once you start writing to it, then you add contents to that file. Okay, so where is this used? So if you are in any program and you hit save, okay, for the first time, let's say you are in a word processor and you hit save, then what your word processor will internally do is first it will create a file of that name. Okay? Then it will take the contents that are in its buffer and take those contents and write them out to that file. Okay? Then the save operation, both of these things are done, the save operation is complete and you have taken what is in your word processor memory and you put a version of it on disk. Okay? So that's how some of these things are used. Okay, so delete is the other operation that's very simple. So you say delete and you give the name of the file. Okay, delete has an E at the end. So I don't know why create doesn't, but anyway it does. So what do you do internally? Once you give the name, You have to first find the directory containing the file. Okay? Then you make sure that the file exists. Okay? If you're trying to delete a file that doesn't exist, that's clearly an error. Okay? And once you have tracked down the file, then you have to free up space. Okay? So all the disk space allocated to that file is now marked as free. Okay? You don't overwrite it, but you mark it as free. And then you remove the file descriptor from the directory. Okay? You just remove the entry from the directory and the file is gone. So that's essentially how delete works. Okay. And there is something about ref counts and hard links, we'll come to that. Okay. So here are open and close. So these are operations on existing files. Okay. So open allows you to open a file that's already on disk to do either read or write or both. Okay. So these are the steps here. Okay. So first of all, the parameters to open are, you specify the file name, you specify the mode in which you want to open the file. Okay, so the mode can be read, write or read write. Okay, read says you open the file for reading, this says you open it for writing only, this says you can read or write. Okay, so you can open in whatever mode you want. Okay, so whenever you get an open call, the OS will check, is the file already open by some other process? Okay, so how will we check that? How does it know? Okay. So you look at the global file table, open file table, which is a global list of all the files, and say, has some other process already opened this file? If it has, then all the attributes, everything is already in RAM, so you can quickly check. Okay. If not, you have to first go to the file system on disk and track this file down. Okay. And then you have to read its metadata and put all of that information into the system-wide open file table. Okay, once you have that, then you will check, does this user have permissions to access the file? Okay, suppose you are trying to read a file, but you have no permissions to access it. This is where you check. Okay, if you have no permission, then you will return an error saying you are not allowed, you don't have sufficient privileges to access this file. Okay, if you do, then I think the open call continues, you increment the count. Okay, this says there's one more process is now has opened this file. You will create an entry in the per process table as well. Okay, that was the global table. Then you create an entry in the per process table. You initialize the file pointer to offset 0. You start from the very beginning of the file. You will initialize the file pointer. And at that point, you are done. You open the file for reading or writing on that matter. Okay. The close will do all the reverse. It will remove the entry from the per process file table. Okay. It will decrement the open count. The open count goes to 0, that means there is no other process in the system that is currently accessing the file, so you can delete the global entry as well. Okay, but the open count is not 0, that means that this process is no longer interested, but there are other processes that may open the same file. Okay, so you will only delete the per process entry, file table entry, but you won't delete the open file table entry. So that will still stay there. Okay, so that's close. Any questions on this? Okay, so now we'll look at some more slightly more interesting ones. There are two we will look at. One is two versions of read. Okay, so after you opened a file, you can actually do IO to it. You can read or write to it. Okay, there are two versions of the read call. One that does random access, the other one does sequential access. Okay. Typically, any access to your file is either sequential or random. Sequential stays says that you basically open the file and read it sequentially from beginning to end. Random basically says once you open the file, you can jump to any location in the file, okay, and then you can read from that location. Okay, so any time you open a file, you will either open it in random access mode or in sequential mode. Okay, so I presume you did some random access reads in lab 0 or lab 1, the first lab. Yes? The inverted index. You do inverted index? No? Yeah.
We just do sequential read into memory and then access it that way.
Did that what you do? Is that what you
do?
Ah, okay.
You had a file and
you just read the whole thing sequentially. Okay, fine. So maybe you didn't do random access. But in any case, the random access allows you to specify an offset in the file and say read from that point on. Sequential access just says read the next n bytes of the file. And the way they are implemented internally, slightly different, but mostly they are similar. Okay, so in random access, you have to first move the file pointer to the specified location. Okay. So you move the file pointer to that location, and then you will read that many bytes on the file. Okay, so this looks like a for loop, but internally this for loop actually goes and triggers IO commands to the disk and reads those contents and returns it in the specified buffer. Okay. So this thing, this file of bytes, is not really a buffer. This is actually saying go read that byte from the file. You actually trigger some IO request to a hard disk. Okay, it will then return that contents from that file, and then you will stick it into this buffer. Okay. Once you have retrieved all the specified number of bytes which are specified in that size, then you basically return that buffer with the contents of that file, with those many bytes from that file. Okay. In sequential access, you basically just read from the file pointer on. Okay, so you will basically just say the file pointer is already pointing to the right location. You just read these many bytes from that point on, stick them into this buffer as is shown here, okay, and you return, and you will basically move the file pointer to the end of this chunk. Okay, so you will increment it by these many bytes. Okay. There is another system called seek, okay, which I think I can show you. Seek allows you to just move the file pointer to wherever you want. Okay, so this is basically not the underlying OS call, but this basically allows you to seek and move the file pointer to a specified location. Okay, this will actually change the location of the file pointer internally. All you have to do in that case is go to the per process file table and just update the location of the file pointer. All that seek is doing is going into this place and just updating this value. Okay, so the next time you read from that, you read from that location. Okay, so write is very similar. Okay, seek just updates the file pointer. Memory mapping, I think we already had mentioned this a while back. What memory map does is it takes a file and it maps it into the address space of the process, so that reads and writes to the file look like reads and writes to memory location. Okay, whenever you read or write to this memory location, internally the OS is going to trigger actual reads and writes to disk. So it's a convenience from a programming standpoint. Rather than issuing explicit read-write request, you mmap the file. Okay, and then you just read it as if it's a sequence of bytes. Okay, yes, question.
Could a process have the same file open more than once?
Could a process have the same file open more than once? Typically, a process cannot have a file open more than once. If you try to open the same file again, you will get an error. Okay, but different processes can definitely have the same file open. Okay, so that is allowed. Okay, so we did talk about sequential and random access. Okay, which says, so common file access patterns are either sequential or random, where you are in sequential are reading the file from beginning to end. In random access, you can jump to any location. Okay. So think about for common applications that you use, which ones do sequential access and which ones do random access. So if you read a file into Word or you open a file in PowerPoint, what type of access is that? Okay, it is sequential. Not only is it sequential, you are reading the entire file into memory all at once. Sequential access doesn't have to read the whole file, it's just reading kind of multiple requests. What sequential and read the whole file in one chunk. Okay, what are examples of random access?
Searching through a file.
Searching through a file. Okay. Any applications that you use that do random access?
Maybe if you're like skipping through songs, like iTunes or something.
Okay, no. You could skip through songs in iTunes.
So you could skip to a point in a song and that would be random
access. Yes. So if you have a slide, if you are listening to music song, move the slider to a particular location and it starts playing from that point on, that's random access. Okay, you are essentially seeking to that position and playing from then from that point on you are doing sequential. Okay, same is true of email. If you have a large mailbox, you jump to the 100th message and open it. Okay? Random access. You basically jump to that and you're reading that. So many accesses will be sequential where you read the whole file, but there are random access. Databases are a good example of random access. In fact, they are the most common example of random access, where your database is a very large file. Okay, you are reading certain entries of that or records of that database. Okay, so you jump to the location where that record is stored and only read that entry, okay, rather than the whole file. Okay, so from an OS's perspective, okay, it is important because the OS does not know a priori how this file is going to be accessed. Okay, it's important for the OS to support both efficient sequential access as well as efficient random access. Okay, we will see that depending on what organization the file system uses. Okay, in some cases sequential access is more efficient. In some cases random access is more efficient. And then there are some where both are reasonable, okay, but not the best. Okay, so when you design your operating system, you have to decide how your file system lays out your files on disk and what data structures are stored in order to efficiently support both of these. Okay, and there we'll see that there are important distinctions depending on how you actually lay out your files on disk. Yeah, but that is coming next time. Okay, today we'll still continue our discussion and talk about names and directories. Okay. So as I have already mentioned, the OS uses a numbering scheme for each file. All files are numbered, all directories are numbered. As far as the OS is concerned, every time you create a file, it gives it a new number. Okay, it doesn't care about the name. As far as the OS is concerned, a name is a string that users have assigned to a file. Okay, it doesn't actually care about it at all. Okay, internally, so there is a table that it keeps that basically maps names to their IDs. Okay. This table is called a directory. Okay. So when you say you have a folder or a directory, essentially what that is a table of some number of files, and it keeps the name of the file and it keeps the ID of the file. Okay. That's essentially what a directory is. Okay. The directory doesn't have any other information. It doesn't actually store the metadata for the file. This data, what the file contains or where all the metadata I was showing you, that's not in the directory. That's stored somewhere else. Okay, all that the directory is, it's a string to number map. It just basically shows you what the two are. In fact, you can actually look at a typical directory, you will see this numbering map. Okay, so let's go to bin. And if you actually open this file, actually it doesn't show you everything. Okay, so maybe that is not the right thing. Okay, so this is actually the table that is in the directory. Okay, so for everything there's a name and there's a number. That's all the directory has. Okay, so this, when you list this, it's showing you basically this is a table with these entries in it. Okay, next time we'll actually see if I open this file, how do I actually know where it's stored on disk and where are the permission bits stored and so on and so forth. That's not stored in the directory, that's stored somewhere else. Okay, so directory is a very simple map. Directory can contain other directories as is stored, as is mentioned here. Okay, so there's, you can have subdirectories and so on. But it's a very simple map that lists numbers of files or directories and strings. Okay. So because directories are hierarchical, which means the directory can contain some other directory and so on, whenever you open a file, you have to run a process called name resolution. So name resolution is a process of mapping the name of the file to its file number. Okay? So, and it's basically it requires multiple operations to do this resolution. So I'll just give you an example. Yeah, so let's say you are looking for user bin, Firefox, or equivalently applications Firefox. Okay, so this is the path name you are going to specify. Okay, so how do you then track down the number that is associated with this file? So the way you are actually going to do this, the name resolution starts from the root directory. Okay? The top level directory is root, which is also called slash. So it will essentially open that directory and say, is there a subdirectory called user in slash? Okay? So if the answer is yes, then it will go and open that directory called user. Okay? So it will basically do whatever I was just showing you. On that, so it will say, is there a string called user that appears in that directory? It will find the entry in here where you basically have the string user, and it will track down this ID. Okay, then it will open this file. Okay, that's another subdirectory, so that's its own table. So then inside that table it will look for a record which has the string bin in there. Okay, so it will basically say, is there a record that has the name bin? Okay, and it will get this entry here. Okay? The answer is yes, then it will open that directory. Okay? So that is yet another directory. So you will basically open bin, and then you will say, is there a string entry with name Firefox? The answer is yes, then you will find the ID. Okay? So you basically recursively descend down the tree, opening each subdirectory one at a time, looking for the next entry in the path, until you hit a leaf. The leaf is the file itself. And at that point you have tracked down the ID for the file you are trying to open. And then you can go and open that file. Okay, using the file open rule. So this name resolution actually has to happen before you can do anything with the file. Okay, this is the process the OS is using to track down the file. And the directories can be nested arbitrarily deep. So you have to then go and open each subdirectory in the path, look for the next entry and so on until you have tracked down the file. It is very slow. If you have things that are nested 10 deep, you will have to do 10 disk accesses to get there. Each of those tables is themselves stored on disk, okay, because the directory information is on disk. So initial name resolution may involve multiple file IOs, disk IOs, to get to that place. Okay, but that's a one-time cost you pay to open the file. Beyond that, you will actually use the index structure to access data from the file. This is not even accessing the data. This is just tracking down the file. Once you have tracked down the file, then you can access the data in the file. Okay? So this process of tracking down the file is referred to as name resolution. Okay? So in single level and multi-level directories, this is simple. If you have arbitrary nesting, which is allowed in most file systems, then it will require lots of IOs. Okay, your question?
Why don't you store the index like in the shortcut? So when you open it, you know, automatically where to find that file. Like, it seems like there's...
I didn't follow what you're saying.
So, like, if you click on a shortcut, it has to, like, yeah, open all that stuff. Why not just have that index right in the shortcut so it just goes straight to the file? It doesn't have to resolve anything.
Yeah, but you could have just opened the file using a Java program, and you may not be double-clicking on it. I could have just say open, and you basically, you can specify a file name inside a process. Okay, so regardless of how you access it, you have to still get to it. Okay, so we'll talk about shortcuts in just one moment. We haven't talked about what shortcuts are yet. Yes.
Why does it store the directory contents as a file, as a separate file for each directory? Why not just have one central file?
Okay, that's a good question. So why is the directory a separate table? Why not just have one gigantic table? That's the question, right? This is the same problem we had when we were talking about page table. When you create a directory, the OS, neither the OS nor the user knows how many files are going to be in that directory. There could be zero files, one file, or 10 million files. Okay? So you don't know how large a table to allocate ahead of time. So that means the direct, and also the directories can grow or shrink. You may create files and you may delete a whole bunch of files. Okay, so since you cannot pre-allocate these tables, you have to let the directory itself grow and shrink. Okay? So the directories need to have the same properties of files, which is they can grow and shrink arbitrarily. Okay? If you kept all the directory in one place, that doing that management would be much harder. so much simpler to just have each directory. So essentially in Unix or most file system, a directory is also a file. Just a special kind of a file that has basically entries of this form. Just names of files and their IDs. Okay, directory is like any other file. You can think of it as a text file where basically each row has a name of a file and an ID of the file. Okay? And you can let the file grow. As you delete entries, the file shrinks. As you add entries, create new files, this directory or this special file grows. Okay? Because the sizes of directories is not known, you cannot store them all in one place. Each of them can be managed independently. That's the reason. It's for flexibility more than anything else. Okay. So multi-level we talked about. Yes, so name, resolution, etc. Okay, so here are, now we'll talk about shortcuts and links and so on. Okay. So this is referred to as referential naming. Okay. So typically I said a file has a certain name associated with it. Okay. This name is mapped to an ID. Okay. It turns out that you can create more than one name for the same file. Okay. These are called aliases. And you can basically have multiple names associated with this file. So you could this is a file. You can have this file, give this name to the file, and you can give a different name to a file. So file always has a primary name and it can have a set of additional names. All these other names are called referential names or aliases for the file. Okay? So if you looked at alias, shortcut or links, they are all basically the same thing. They are called references to this file. A file can have multiple names and we'll see how that makes it interesting. In Unix, there are two types of aliases you can create. What is called hard links and soft links. Hard aliases and soft aliases. Okay. So essentially hard link is an actual second name for the file. Okay. So in this case, as is shown here, initially A maps to file number 100. And if you use the command ln, which is link, short for link, and you say ln AB, then you have created a second name for the file called B. Okay. If you open file A, you get to the same file. If you open file B, also you get to the same file. The names are identical in all respects. They are just two different names for the same files. These names can reside in different directories and whatnot. Okay. Now the interesting thing is what happens. So basically files can have as many names as you want. You can create 25 names for the same file. Doesn't matter. Okay. Now the interesting thing that happens is what happens if you delete, let's say file A. Okay. So you say delete A. So if you delete A, what the operating system will do is it will just remove the entry for A from its directory. It won't actually delete the file itself because there is another name for the file and you could have accessed the file that way. Okay? Only when you delete all the names for the file is the file actually deleted. Okay, is that clear what I just said? Typically a file has only one name, okay, in the more at the common case. So when you delete a file, its directory entry is removed as well as the file itself goes away. Okay? But if your file has multiple names, then when you delete one of the names, only the entry from the directory is removed. Okay, the file itself does not go away because there are other valid names for the files that have not yet been deleted. Okay? Only if you delete, so in this case if you delete A and you delete B, is that file itself deleted. That's basically the semantics that the file system provides to you. Okay, you can actually try this out. Okay, so here let's do a small experiment. Okay, so I'll create a file called foo. Okay, we'll say, so we'll enter some text. Okay, so here is foo. Okay, so I'm going to give it a second name. Okay, so I'm going to link foo to bar. Okay, so now you have, okay, so these are now two independent, as far as the OS directory is concerned, there are two entries. Okay, there's a file called foo, there's a file called bar. Okay, if you actually go and look, you will see that they both point to the same file. Okay, so they have the same number. Because all that you have done is added a directory entry called foo that points to that number, added a directory entry called bar that also points to the same number. So essentially there are two names for this file. Okay. So I'm going to now go and delete foo. Okay. So now foo is gone. Okay, so okay, that's basically that's what happened. But the file is not gone because file is still here. You can see that bar still exists. If you actually open bar, the file is still there. Okay, because the second name that's still valid, I haven't deleted that name. Now if I actually remove bar, then the file goes away. Because all entries are gone at that point, the file is gone. Okay? So this is the semantics that our file system will have for you. If there are multiple names for the file, then only when all of those names are deleted is the file actually deleted. Until then you only delete the directory entry, but not the file contents. Okay, those are basically differentiate between what you are deleting. Okay. By default you will delete the directory entry and the content, but if there are multiple names for the file, you only delete the first piece.
Is there a way to see all of the hard links to a file? Because we might be interested, you know, if you change bar, to know that foo will also change.
Yes, is there a way to figure this out? There is a way to figure this out. You can actually check. Let's see if that we can figure that out. Okay, we can create another one called... Okay, and then we'll say lemon bar foo. Oops. Yeah, hard links you cannot. Soft links you can. I'll come back to soft links. I'll show you. Hard links, I think you can. You'll need to use some special tools. Otherwise, it's hard. Okay. So this is one thing. Okay. So files can have multiple names, and because if you associate multiple names to a file, special things happen when you delete a file. Okay. So now, if you go back, so why did this happen? If you go back to the delete operation that I was showing you earlier. Delete go. Okay, so here this is why I said ref counts and hard links. Okay. So what delete essentially does is what it will do is it will find a directory containing the file you have specified. It will remove that entry, it will reduce the ref count. Ref count basically is how many different names do you have for the file. That is tracked by the OS. Okay. It will decrement the ref count. If the ref count goes to zero, only then you will free the disk blocks of the file. If the ref count is non-zero, you know that there is one, at least one other valid name for this file. So you will not delete the file content. Only delete the directory entry for the file. You only do this step, not that step. Okay, so this basically you will have to do all these additional checks because of what I was just showing you. Okay, so that is what is hard links. So there are soft... Yes, question. If you copy and paste a file, it's not a hard link. You're just creating a duplicate file which has the same contents, but they are two independent files. Okay, so that's not the same as a hard link. Okay. So there's something called a soft link. So in Windows, when you do a shortcut, that's a soft link. In Mac OS X, when you do an alias, that's a soft link also. Okay. Soft link is essentially a symbolic pointer. So rather than giving two names for the file, all that the soft link does is it contains a pointer to the actual name for the file. Okay, you say if you open this file, go and look up this other file instead. So the content of the soft link actually point to the actual file link. Okay, so the difference here is in this hard links there are two names for this file. You create a soft link. So if this is a soft link to this file, this will actually create a point, has a pointer to user bin foo. So if you open this, what it will say is go look that up. It's like a forwarding address. It will say if you want to access this, go look that file up. So then you have to go take this entry and then go open that file, and then that gets you to this file. Okay? That's essentially what a shortcut does. Okay? And the way you will do this is with the minus S command, which says soft. So you can do the same thing. So symbolic also, same thing. So symbolic links are soft links. Okay. So A is pointing to 100. If you do ln minus S here, okay, A, B, then basically B is a pointer to A. B is not pointing to this file. In the previous case, B and A are pointing to the same file. Here B just points to this file. So that's basically short link. There are two things I want to mention before you go. One is, if you create soft links, you may have dangling pointers. Okay, so if you basically, the previous case, if I had created a soft link to bar, okay, so I can show you that quickly. Okay, so let's remove foo. Okay, so bar is already a file, not car. Okay, so if I do ls minus a bar to foo. Okay, so you will see that there is a difference. This is a soft link. So bar is a file, foo is a pointer to bar. Foo is not another name for this file, it's just a pointer, it's like a forwarding thing. Okay, now if I actually delete bar here, okay, foo is still there, but it's a dangling pointer. Okay, this file it is pointing to doesn't exist. So the entry is still there, but this is an error. So if I try to open foo, rather if I do cat foo, it's going to basically try to look up a file called bar, which no longer exists. Okay, so this is like a missing shortcut in Windows, where you created a soft link, but the original file went away. This would not happen if you created a hard link, because the hard link actually points to the file, so the file itself is not deleted. Okay. Yes, question. I'm sorry, what's the question? Okay, if you did not delete bar, then foo would actually open bar and you will actually get it. Then it would work the same as a hard link. Okay, if it's a valid one, there's no difference between a hard and a soft link. But the only problem comes in deletion. And when you delete a hard link, the other name is still valid. In a soft link, if you delete the original, the link becomes invalid. Yes.
So foo's
that would still be work. That would still work because it doesn't know that the bar has gone and come back. Okay, so I now created a new one. So if I do foo, because it just basically all it is saying is go. It's like a really a forwarding address that you leave at the post office. If you have mail for this, deliver it somewhere else. So that's all it is. If some new person came to live in that house, you'll still get mail in the same place. Same thing. That's one thing. The last thing to mention is when you have hard links, okay, because of certain problems that can arise, you are not allowed to create hard links for directories. You can have multiple names for a file, but you are not allowed to have multiple names for a directory. Okay? And the reason for this is to prevent loops in your directory structure. Okay, so here is an example where you have directory A that has these three things in there. B is a file, C is a file, D is a directory, and then D subdirectory, it has two things, E and F, and you created a link from F back to the parent. This creates a loop. If you are allowed to have hard link, this would create a loop. Okay? Loops are bad in file systems, okay, because they can cause arbitrarily bad things to happen. So for instance, if you are creating a backup of this this directory, then that backup program would never terminate. Yeah, because it will basically come to D, it will say I need to backup D, so you will go and open this directory, you will backup file E, and you try to backup F, you come back here and you will sit in a loop and the program never terminate. So because of these problems, you don't allow hard links on directories. So if you try to create a hard link on a directory, you will get an error. But soft links are allowed, because soft links you can distinguish. Yes, you can create a soft link from any directory to any other directory, but hard links you don't allow. Okay. So we'll just show one example and we'll end there. Okay, so we can make dir one. That's a directory. If I do dir one, okay, so you'll basically get an error saying it's a directory, so it's not allowing me to create a hard link. Okay, to prevent this problem, we'll just throw an error. Okay, so we are going to stop here for today. We'll pick up the discussion from tomorrow, okay, so which is Thursday.